Hi, this is Dee Blick. Welcome to Lead Well, Live Well for UK Health Radio. Hello and welcome to Lead Well, Live Well with me, Dee Blick, for UK Health Radio, the world's number one talk health radio station. Thank you for joining us. It's lovely to have your company. Now, in the studio today, we have the brilliant David Beeney, the top 101 global influencer on mental health and author of the book Breaking the Silence. I have to tell you that this is a book that has really changed my perspective on the anxiety that has pretty much been my companion on and off for most of my life. David Beeney, it's a real pleasure to be chatting with you today. Welcome.
Thank you, Dee. It's such a pleasure to be here. I've been really looking forward to this morning. Thank you so much for inviting me.
That's wonderful, David. Now, before we really do a deep dive into mental health and how it affects us, let's just start with the incredible story of the cover of your book, which is you shouting into the abyss. Tell me how that cover came about.
Oh, Dee, it nearly didn't happen. I'd been working in York that morning and I suddenly got a call asking me to go to these photo studios in somewhere in London with this guy called Rankin. And I'll be honest, Dee, I hadn't heard of Rankin. And I so nearly was coming up with excuses not to go all the way into London because it was a very, very hot, sultry day. I chose to go and it was one of the most amazing experiences of my life. I don't know a lot about photography and I wondered what made someone a world brilliant photographer. Well, keeping it really short, I went into this room and Rankin said to me, "I want you to scream like you've never screamed before." So I screamed and he said, no, I want you to properly scream. And he got me to sort of just become someone I'd never been in my life before because I was trying to portray how I really felt at times with my anxiety behind the mask. And he absolutely captured that. And I had no idea on that day that that photograph would be on the front cover of my book that came out several years later. So fantastic experience. And Rankin, what a guy. What a guy.
And that is when I saw that and I saw that Rankin, I mean, he is a world famous photographer. I've seen him on the TV several times and it is a brilliant cover of your book that really grabs attention in all the right ways. Now, you didn't start your career as one of the top 100 global mental health influencers, did you?
No, I certainly didn't. What's bizarre, Dee, is that I spent 36 years working in media, having an okay career, but I'm more known for what I've done since I was 54 years old than what I did for the first, as I say, huge part of my career. I completely lost my way because of my anxiety and my battles with panic attacks. And when in 10 years ago this year, I chose to out myself about my mental health, I can't believe what's happened in those 10 years. I spent most of my career doing everything possible to avoid public speaking because of my secret battles with panic attacks. And now I do talks and interviews almost every day. And I've been so lucky in the last 10 years to work with so many amazing organizations around the world. I do have to pinch myself. I feel so lucky to do what I do. Thank you, Dee.
But you started out in media, didn't you, in a really tough gig. Was it advertising sales where you, that is a heck of a tough job to have. And so I can understand that you felt anxiety because I too started out. I mean, I was in marketing, but also with a specific responsibility for advertising. And I know that my anxiety was on steroids and that was how you started your career. But you rose through the ranks really quickly, didn't you, to get to the top of your tree in that particular hard career? You
know, what I will say is that it is a tough career, Dee, but from 18 to 24 years old, I was quite a confident young guy and I wasn't that fazed by it. And I found that I quite enjoyed talking to customers about advertising. And then on the 2nd of September, 1986, everything changed because I'd been doing that well. I'd been promoted to become a trainer. And on the first day of my new job, I'd been asked to interview somebody alongside my manager. And it was in that interview that I suddenly couldn't breathe. I suddenly couldn't talk. And I didn't know now, but sorry, I didn't know at the time. But looking back, I was having my first major panic attack in a workplace scenario. I had it again the following day, another interview. And at 24 years old, I thought my career was over. I thought, there's no way I can be a trainer. There's no way I can carry on in a sales career if I can't talk to one person for a few minutes without becoming breathless. And at that time, at the beginning of September, it was 1986. For the next 30 odd years, I did suffer. I really struggled in the world of media to hide my panic attacks from the world around me. And my career, in some ways, flourished because of it when I look back. But equally, I never fulfilled my true potential because of this constant battle with anxiety. Thank you, Dee.
Gosh, I'm sort of nodding my head at everything that you said there, because my first panic attack in work was when I was 22, and I'd been selected out of hundreds of people for this position as a graduate trainee in marketing. And I can vividly remember going with my boss up to London. We used to go up to London to meet the advertising agencies, which was all very fabulous. And in the taxi rank, I started this panic attack and it absolutely overwhelmed me. And I still look back and think, how did I cope? In that, rather than fall apart in the taxi rank, I felt the panic rising, my heart was pounding, my mouth went dry. I actually thought I was going to be sick. And I think, thank goodness there was a big queue. And I excused myself to go to the loo, where I literally fell apart. And I think once that had happened, it was almost as though the seed was sown for these panic attacks to make the most random appearances, invariably when I was about to present a project. And again, I had these strategies of just must pop to the loo. I think they all thought I had IBS or something, because it was a way of managing what was really something quite insidious and unmanageable. And we'll talk about this more after the break. But for me, I felt this incredible shame that this black dog of anxiety had chosen me. And I've got to tell you, and again, we'll explore this after the break, that for the first time in my life, and like you, I'm 63, your book, Breaking the Silence, has enabled me to reframe my anxiety as a bit of an asset, and you refer to it as our superpower, don't you?
I do. And I many years ago, someone said to me, David, what you need to do is to make a friend of your anxiety. And at the time they said that, I thought that's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard in my life. Many years later, I completely got it. Now I've made anxiety part of me and I've accepted it's okay not to be okay. I have turned it into something that is giving me the best time of my life, both in terms of my well-being, but also in terms of what I'm achieving. It's amazing how we now view our anxiety so different to we did earlier in our lives.
I completely agree with you. And I think, as I was saying to you before we started the interview, for me, it's about being flawed, as in LAWAD, not OOR, flawed and fabulous. And that really is, for me now, is living a life of authenticity, when I can accept my flaws and foibles, but with a healthy dose of accepting my fabulousness. And it's something that, with this show, I really want to convey to listeners, that we can be this whole mixed bundle of magnificence, where there are areas of our character that we are frustrated with, but this does not have to define us. And I just loved your explanation. I love it in the book, of anxiety being your superpower. So we're now going to move to a break for a few seconds, but don't go away, because when we get back, David's going to be talking about beautiful constraints. We're going to be talking more about his book and why he believes that you inspire people when you share vulnerability.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. Good. the station that makes you feel good.
Welcome back to Lead Well, Live Well with me, Dee Blick, and I'm just delighted to have the fabulous David Beeney with me in the studio today. Now, David, I loved your description in the book of beautiful constraints, which is a concept pioneered by the strategist Adam Morgan. Tell me more about beautiful constraints and how people with anxiety are almost at a subconscious level used to creating them without even knowing that they are beautiful.
Great question, Dee. As I said before the break, at 24 years old, I thought my career was over because I had a panic attack when I was interviewing one person for a few minutes. And I just got this job as a trainer. As you'd know, training back in the late 80s, early 90s, we had an overhead projector and acetates. Remember acetates?
Yeah.
And you just talked to people hour after hour, and training was incredibly boring. And I thought, how can I stand in a training room with everyone staring at me hour after hour? There's no way I'll do that without becoming completely breathless and very anxious. So I thought to myself, I've got to quit. I've got to leave my job. But then I thought, how about if I try and take the focus off myself? How about if I try and get the people in the room doing the work? So I got loads of handouts prepared, and I started putting people into breakout groups and getting them presenting back to me. Within 6 months, Dee, my boss had resigned because she said everyone finds me boring. And the job I thought I couldn't do for one day, within 6 months, I'd been promoted to a senior trainer, and I'm still 24 years old. And I built a reputation as a very good trainer. And someone once described me as a trainer ahead of my time. I wasn't a trainer ahead of my time. I wasn't clever. I wasn't creative. I was simply this young guy trying to avoid having panic attacks. But it made me a very effective trainer. Off the back of becoming a good trainer, I was fast-tracked into senior management. Within years, I'm managing very large teams. But I was still using the same sort of techniques every day. I wasn't the sort of manager to stand in front of my team and do all the talking. I'd get them doing, you know, all the work and getting very engaged. And I built a reputation again as a very engaging type of leader who very much was into my people development. Again, some of that's true, but most of it was I was trying to avoid having panic attacks, but it made me a very effective leader. So in many ways, when I look back at my career, I was a managing director of a regional daily newspaper by the age of 35. And the key to my success was my beautiful constraint of trying to manage my panic attacks. Just to give this balance, Dee, and I'll finish in a moment, but just to give this balance, it did finally catch up with me. In my late 30s, I lost my way. It became too tiring to try and find ways of constantly avoiding panic attacks. And my career really, really went nowhere in the end. And I didn't fulfill my true potential because I didn't have the courage to open up and talk about my secret battles with anxiety.
I just love that. I love your response there, David. And it really resonated with me, every word you said there and every word in your book, that I realized too, as a trainer, that I was on the verge of having a panic attack at a big event in Bognor, which is in the south of England. And I was thinking, I can't carry on like this. I can't carry on with these high power, high impact introductions, because the anxiety that I'm placing upon myself is just too much for me to bear. And I did just what you did. I developed these beautiful constraints where I got the delegates involved up front. And then, just as you have said, I started to talk about it. I started to talk about it when I was on really big platforms. I became a highly paid professional speaker. And I would open up by just saying, hi, it's great to see you all today. Now, I would imagine you're looking forward to what I've got to say. What I need to share is I'm really excited to be here. My heart is pounding. It's a mixture of nerves and excitement. And I learned as well that by being relatable and being authentic, that it took the sting out of what I was about to do, which invariably was present on a big stage. And even now I organise events and I have to stand in front of big audiences. And I say the same, because people are often going, I'd never guessed that you were anxious, Dee, or that you lack confidence at the start of doing a presentation. And what I love about that is, one, it takes the pressure off of me, and two, it shows others that it's okay not to go into something that does make your heart pound, and to be so serene and calm that you're almost unreal. So I really loved your answer there, and I loved it when I read that in the book, and I thought, blimey, really what I thought was something to be shameful about was the little strategies I've been deploying to cope are, in fact, I've reframed them as these beautiful constraints. So now I want to talk about your brilliant book, Breaking the Silence, how it started and how it's been received, because in me, you have a very vocal number one fan.
Thank you, Dee. I never, ever thought I'd have a book. People always said to me, David, there's a book inside you, but I failed my English O-level, as it was called in those days. My grammar's not brilliant, and I'm a great storyteller in person, but I'm not great at writing things down. And luckily for me, about 3 years ago, someone approached me and said, can I write your book? And I said, are you serious? And they said, yeah, can I write your book? I'm a ghostwriter. So to cut a long story short, I met with them several times. I agreed that they would write my book. And I went through that whole experience of having someone writing a book for me. And when I first read it back, I thought, wow, this sounds like me. And I then spent a lot of time, obviously, sort of adding things in and making sure I felt it was very much my own story. And yes, it came out in May 2024, and I'm so proud of it. I am so proud of it. I always have it with me. Doesn't make good radio, but I'm holding it now, as you can see.
Yes, I can see.
And always take it with me. And I'm very proud of the book. Really proud of the book. Thanks, Dee.
What I really liked about your book is the size of it. I just started reading The Chimp Paradox, which is a great book, but I found it overwhelming. It's one of those books where you have to make a concerted effort to read it. And like I say, it's a brilliant book, but I'm only about halfway through it, and I started it several months ago. I started your book, and the first thing I thought was, hallelujah, this is a lovely size. It's not so big that it becomes a chore to read. But you've packed everything into that book, literally everything. It's a book as well that I just want to talk before the break. I want you to share who's your ideal reader, because when I was reading it, I thought this book spans so many different readers in different professions, you know, from the personal to professional. So tell me who are your ideal readers for this book?
My ideal reader is anyone who's suffering in any form of silence about their mental health, who feels scared and stigmatized, worried about the stigma of mental health, to talk about their mental health. I mean, you're a classic ideal reader, Dee. As we've discussed, you know, where we have a lot in common, and it's not just our age. It's the fact that we've both spent most of our life sort of battling with anxiety, with no one around us having any idea about it. And it's been a lot later in life we've realised it's okay not to be okay. There's been good progress made in recent years about the stigma of mental health, particularly in the UK. But we've got a long, long way to go. There are thousands and thousands of people who, they don't just suffer in silence at work. They suffer in silence in front of their families as well,
yeah.
Particularly men. You know, particularly men. So I want to break the silence. The book's called Breaking the Silence because I broke my silence after 36 years. But I want to, the stigma of mental health is this wall of silence out there. And I want to break the silence out there for so many more people to feel they've got the courage to talk about without fear about their true mental well-being. Thanks, Dee.
I think that's a great response, David. And now stay with me. We're going to the break. And after the break, I'm going to be sharing with David some of the bits that I really liked in his book and asking him to explain a bit more. Then we'll talk about how he manages his anxiety now because he speaks at some amazing events. And then finally, David will flip the table and ask me a question and share his favourite inspirational quote.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Welcome back to Lead Well, Live Well with me, Dee Blick, with the amazing David Beeney, the author of Breaking the Silence. Now, David, I just want to read some little bits that, I mean, gosh, I started reading your book and then I read it again with my pen. And you know, when you're highlighting so many bits, you just think, stop it, just stop it. Because if you're highlighting every bit, then what are you going to pick out? But I did manage for this interview, tough as it was, to single out bits that I absolutely loved. And it was, I love this bit about you said, mental health challenges can foster creativity and innovative thinking. Those with mental health challenges, have incredible empathy and understanding towards others facing similar challenges. You also say, David, which I loved, I was high-fiving you here, that we have high emotional intelligence and self-awareness. So let's just go back to that first point, that mental health challenges can foster creativity and innovative thinking.
Dee, I'm going to tell a story that you've triggered that I haven't spoken about probably for 25, 30 years. I was going to a big advertising agency who'd recently criticised the regional press for not being sexy enough. And I worked in regional press. Now, whenever I was going to a big agency, the first thing that came into my head is, how do I avoid having a panic attack? All I would think about is not my content, is can I get through this without becoming breathless? Now, I remember that the guy I was presenting to had criticized, as I say, my industry for not being sexy enough. So way back in the 80s, before this was more common, I asked someone to put makeup on me. I bought myself a pink shirt, I wore a big medallion, I wore eyeliner, I had blusher on, I walked into what was Saatchi & Saatchi, one of the biggest advertising agencies in the world, to have a bit of fun and be creative by being really, really sexy. Now, I got huge plaudits for doing that, and people said that took real courage to go in and do that. What I was really doing, Dee, was just trying to avoid having a panic attack by making people laugh. But so often in my career, things that I did a bit different, yes, people had no idea why I was doing it, but it actually enhanced what I was trying to do. But really what was going on was me trying to avoid having panic attacks. So I think I'd forgotten that story. Thanks for prompting it. Thank you.
Tell me the bit. So why do those of us with mental health challenges, why do we have empathy and high emotional intelligence?
I think when I was training to become a mental health counsellor, there was 18 of us on the course, and none of us realised until we all got to know each other, all 18 of us had had therapy. All 18 of us had had irrational thoughts and challenges in our life. And I think when you experience what are irrational thoughts, it just gives you more empathy that what other people might be going through. And you do try and put yourself in the shoes of someone else. So later in my career, if I was interviewing someone who was particularly nervous, I wouldn't worry about that. I'd actually get inspired by their vulnerability. So I think it's because of our own experiences. It just helps us really put ourselves into other people's shoes to really understand what they might be going through. Yeah. Thank you, Dee.
I love that because it's something that I probably always taken for granted that a lot of people confide in me or they're able to share what's going on in their head, whether that's clients. I built a successful business over 40 years and I found that the business founders that I work with, they never shrink from sharing some of their biggest challenges, even if it's around mental health. And I think you're right that there's nothing like actually having suffered in a way with your mental health, had to be adaptive and develop these beautiful constraints. It definitely sets you up for being a more empathetic person because you've got a good understanding of what somebody may be going through. And I just want to pick this standout line for me from your book before you tell me about how you now manage anxiety and you flip the tables on me. Is it flip the tables or flip the switch? Well, you know what I mean. You asked me a question. I love this line, and it really resonated with me because it's something that I speak about often, whether I'm talking to my mastermind group members, I'm on a stage or doing a webinar. And you wrote, "I genuinely believe that you inspire people when you share vulnerability." That is a big old statement there, you inspire. So tell me more about that.
I remember going to, I was involved with the graduate selection day in London a number of years ago. The graduates had to all come to the front and talk about something they were passionate about. And they were all brilliant. One talked about skiing, one talked about horses. But Abigail then came to the front of the room and said, "Hi, everybody. My name's Abigail and I've got bipolar." And for the first time that day, people stopped whispering.
Yeah.
For the first time that day, the room fell silent and everybody hung on to Abigail's every single word. And not surprising, the first name that everybody wrote down that day they wanted to recruit was Abigail, because she inspired us by sharing her vulnerability. And since that day, a number of years ago, I have seen that happen so many times. I know now that when you share vulnerability, you're inspiring people around you to be their authentic selves. And that's a real, a great thing to be able to do. So all of us, you know, everyone listening today, you know, we do inspire people when we share vulnerability. We won't be seen as weak. We will be seen as inspirational. Thanks, Dee.
Oh, I love that. And I think I'm with you every step of the way there, that I realised when I began to share my vulnerabilities. So, for example, I began sharing that I'm a recovering alcoholic with many years of sobriety. And funnily enough, I was auditioned by the WI, the Women's Institute, and they decided that they wanted lots of WI groups to hear my story. And my story is from addict to author. And I've recently been invited to do a TED talk, and I met the organizers and said, "I really want to share my story of overcoming addiction and anxiety." It's not so much overcoming anxiety, it's better managing it. I've overcome addiction, but I manage my anxiety so much better. And I wanted to share that. I'm not interested in putting forward a polished performance if it means I sacrifice my vulnerability, because fundamentally, like you, I want to be relatable. I want people to read my columns, to listen to me on the radio and think, "Wow, that's great." But the fact that I'm sharing that I'm perfectly imperfect, I'm fabulously flawed, just as we all are. And my view now is there's not enough life left to be masking and hiding our magnificence and our foibles as well. So I want now to, in the closing minutes of our interview, before you ask me a question and share your amazing quote, which I can see in your office in the background, tell me, you are now a speaker for some of the biggest brands in the world. It's quite jaw-dropping and thoroughly well-deserved. But you're putting yourself out there, undoubtedly. And how do you manage your anxiety now?
I always thought I'd find a cure for my panic attacks, but I've accepted I'll never be cured. I had my last panic attack in the last few days. But I think I've realised these days what happens when I feel the demons returning and I find myself becoming very anxious. I literally stand there and I say to myself, "Sod it, just have one."
Yeah.
You know, show everyone what it looks like to have a panic attack. The irony is, the moment I give myself permission to have one, I massively reduce the chances of them happening. When I look back at my life, I've spent far too much of it being hard on myself, thought I had to be perfect every day. In our careers, particularly, we often talk about raising the bar. We say, "Right, this year I'm going to raise the bar." Well, do you know what David Beeney's done? He's lowered his bar. He hasn't lowered his standards. He hasn't lowered his aspirations. He's discovered the true value of self-compassion, which is about being kinder to yourself. Now, when you become kinder to yourself, two things happen. One, you bring down your levels of stress. And secondly, you become more productive and creative, because when you function with a more relaxed state of mind, you get greater clarity of thought. And when you get greater clarity of thought, you get more things done. So in short, Dee, the way I get through these talks and workshops and radio interviews these days, I give myself permission to have a panic attack. In other words, I'm being kinder to me. And by being kinder to me, I've largely won my battle with my anxiety. Thanks, Dee.
Oh, I love that. I think I wish that I'd had that advice. It's taken me to get to the age of 63. I think I've been probably managing my anxiety in some of the ways you've described, but it was reading your book and I just thought, this is part of me. This has been part of me since a pretty traumatic childhood where anxiety almost became embedded within me. And this last week, I've been going through fluctuating levels of anxiety. And I think there was one day this week when, a bit like you, my heart began to pound and I got the old dryness in the mouth and the panic was rising. And I just thought, take your foot off the pedal. And if anybody asks how you are, just say, actually, today's a really anxious day. And I did that. I shared with a few people. I had a friend that messaged me about a business proposition. And I wrote back and just said, I'm completely full up mentally today. I am in an anxious state of mind. So the best thing that I'm going to do is have a cup of tea, go for a walk, come back, watch a bit of trash on the TV. And just in doing that and sharing with a few people that were like, are you okay? And I was like, well, actually, I'm not okay today. Because I became the master over so many years of, are you okay, Dee? Yeah, absolutely. I'm fabulous. I'm fine. When behind it, I was in such mental turmoil that I didn't know where to put myself. And so I love what you're saying about accepting ourselves as we are, giving ourselves permission to be anxious, because it's like once we take the sting out of it, we reduce the power that anxiety holds over us. And that for me is a massive thing. And I think what's lovely about you, David, is that you are using your platform to inspire and empower thousands of people worldwide where their mental health can fluctuate. It might fluctuate from month to month. It might be occasionally they have episodes where their mental health is not supporting them. But I think with voices like yours, you must reach so many people that maybe like me, for the first time in their lives, they realise that it's absolutely okay to be in the mental state I'm in now, and let's talk about it. And that's where I am now, is I talk about it. Like you, I want others to look at me and think, oh, that's great. Somebody said to me the other day, I thought you were quite intimidating, but you're actually quite, I think that was quite normal. I thought that was quite amusing, but it was simply that the impression they'd formed of me was this version A, and I'm not. There is so much more depth to us than we're a bit like the Titanic iceberg, that the bit on top is but a mere sliver of what really goes on underneath. And there's like a moral imperative for you and for me and for others that have got a platform, David, to be able to share this. So I'm now going to hand over to you with your favourite quote and your question for me.
And my question, and you've nearly answered it. I was going to say, you know, we both these days have largely won our battles with anxiety. But as I shared just now, I've accepted I'll never be cured. And I was going to ask you when you'd had your last full-blown panic attack, where you were and why.
I think I would say it was this week. It was this week in the afternoon that I had the panic attack. And it was because I began to overthink all the things that are happening in my life at the moment. So, as you know, I've written a book that you very kindly contributed to about personal branding. And I'm doing lots of promotion for that. I've recently become a commissioning editor for a big media brand, and I've taken on this wonderful show. And then a client quite innocuously messaged me and said, could I do some extra work? And it sparked my panic attack. And that was when I had to take my foot off the pedal and think, it's okay, just let's recede now into the background. I used to put so much emphasis on my panic and anxiety, thinking there was something wrong with me, that it would then fuel more anxiety, whereas accepting it as it's just part of me. There are so many wonderful aspects of me and my character, as there are with all of us. That the panic attack, thankfully, it was quite short-lived. I knew it was coming. I could feel it with the lightheadedness, the heart pounding and all the wonderful symptoms. It's a reminder to me that I'm real, that I'm human, that I'm flawed and I'm fabulous, just as we all are. So there, I've shared that for the first time ever.
Thank you. And when I first ever shared my battles with panic attacks, one of my best friends said to me, David, thank you. Today, I've realized I'm normal. Because so many people have panic attacks but don't talk about them. So my quote, which fits in with all of that, it really is okay not to be okay. That's just not a phrase that we throw out there about mental health. It really does mean something. We've really got to embrace that and accept it really is okay not to be okay. Thank you, Dee. I have so enjoyed this morning. It's been great being interviewed by you.
It's been wonderful having you on the show, David, and I love that. It's okay to not be okay. I can see it in your office there on the wall. I think it's fabulous, and I will take that with me. And sadly, I'd like just to talk to my listeners. I mean, huge thanks to you, David Beeney, for joining us today on this show. It's been absolutely wonderful. Now, if you've been listening to this and you've either got your own business or you work for an organisation and you're struggling with anxiety, don't go it alone. Take the sting out of your anxiety, share it, talk to people, step into your circle of trust. And also, I would say that recognize that when you do step into this circle of trust and you feel that you can share without judgment, something truly amazing happens. You also step into your circle of power. So that's me, Dee Blick. It's been lovely having your company today, and I look forward to sharing more amazing guests with you in the coming weeks. Thank you.
You've been listening to Lead Well, Live Well on UK Health Radio.